Derwick's Little Sister, a two-part additional discussion, part two, 26 minutes.
Yeah. I actually have a question regarding that. So in this individuation process, you need to like give up this ego strength, like this confidence that you have to move on, right? But what if the person is not self-confident, like hasn't really built up that ego strength?
Well then, yeah.
How does it go? Is it the same? It also has to.
It's hard to generalize because there's so many different. I mean, the old traditional concept is that in the first half of life, one is building up ego strength. In the second half of life, one is beginning to go beyond that, let go of it.
But it has to go like that, or.
Well, if you don't have, we were talking about. Pretty made a bronca in this class and in telling stories, right? Bronca had to tell her own story in order to relate to the devil. She had to be fiercely determined not to tell him everything that he had shown her, but tell the story the way she chose. She was in control of the story. And the serpent in the Egyptian story demanded that the sailor tell his story and the serpent would tell her story. So there has to be a dialogue between equals. That requires a strong ego. Without a strong ego, you can't have a dialogue. You just get swamped. So it's easy enough to get swamped by the unconscious, and that can lead to psychosis. You know, if you're exhausted and weakened, or perhaps weakened because you were young, you know, if your ego strength diminishes because of stress or exhaustion or whatever, then your paranoid fantasies or delusions in the unconscious can begin to take over and become delusions, so you can slip into a psychotic state. So in that sense, an encounter with the unconscious can be very dangerous unless the ego is relatively secure. So in psychological work, when one is working as a therapist, oftentimes you're simply working with people, in that first half of life task, you know, learning to be more. But these are rather arbitrary distinctions. In fact, both things are really going on in both phases of life. It's a little simplistic. But yeah, we need a strong ego in order to
go in that integration process.
In order to have a dialogue, yeah.
Well, is it the strength of the ego, or is it the overwhelming interjection of the ego? Because, you know, maybe even with weak people, I'm not sure if I can put in words exactly, but even a weak person has a strong ego complex that needs to be, I suppose, let go.
I'm not sure how we, you know, these words can be used in different ways. When I talk about a strong ego, I guess what I'm saying is having well-developed ego functions like reality testing or being able to articulate one's thoughts, being able to tolerate frustration, being able to suppress. Being able to repress thoughts or feelings when necessary. You know, the strong ego functions. In ego psychology, you can list the functions. There's 5 or 10 of them. So that's what I mean by a strong ego. I don't mean a complex that, I don't know, those are complicated words. Now, when you talk about complexes, you're using Jungian psychological terms.
No, it's just a good question. I forgot her name, which she had. It seems the envision process, even with someone with kind of a weak will, it's kind of similar. The rest of them, the same kind of demons, like an overpowering complexes, or,
well,
Donald Trump and the guy on the, who, you know, you might say has a strong ego, and a wino on the street, you know, who supposedly is kind of weak willed. You know, it seems like their battle is kind of similar.
The demons may be the same, but the ego is not necessarily the same. You know, the rhino on the street may have a pretty fragmented or depleted ego structure, so it doesn't have much self-discipline or strength to bring to bear.
So there's kind of a real danger for people who go into the unconscious, sort of try to, if their ego is not really strong, what you're saying. I mean, if anybody goes into dreams or goes really heavily into all of this, trying to get that strong ego,
you can lose it. I mean, some people are defending against it. What some theorists call a psychotic core. They have an ego that functions okay in the world. As long as they keep their life fairly well buttoned down, it might be. Have a steady job, but not a very complicated or not a very stressful job. Mm-hmm. A steady job, and they may go through life fairly successfully or at least comfortably. But it would not be a good idea for them to probe into the core of their unconscious being, because what's in there is not well integrated. So then, if such a person goes into analysis by mistake, and the analyst relentlessly encourages them to bring the dreams and probe deeper and deeper into their interior, they can lose it, and then that's a big mistake and destructive. Because who's to say that was a desirable outcome for somebody who was functioning okay? Yeah.
If he doesn't want to know, there's nothing that you can say. Probably he will not hear.
Yeah, that's right. Somebody is not ready to know, if you want to know, then there's no point.
Yeah, because he has, he wants success, power, whatever.
Right.
And now, but this guy that you're describing is willing to get to the balance, to understand what he's missing.
Yes. Right. Yes. Yeah. Not easy. It's not easy for anybody.
And although he may want to know it now, but may not really be able to work on it until 2 years from now.
Well,
sometimes that's
his his decision.
Yes, that's absolutely
true.
Yeah.
Now I quote often Freud's statement that of all the races that he ever encountered, the only race that he found impervious to psychoanalysis was the Irish. And yeah. And
racial stereotyping there.
But I wonder. Yeah, no. But I travel to Ireland quite often, and it seems like talking about, there seems to be a berserker sort of cultural. They've been repressed for a lot of years. The Irish, just historically, they were overrun by the Vikings and the Normans and all that, and it kind of got to be a little bit of a matriarchal society. Because the men were drinking. It's not stereotype. It's a historical fact. The potato famine was caused not by a lack of resources, but because the English just stole all the potatoes. So I wonder if there's that kind of dangerous psychic energy that's below the surface that perhaps makes psychoanalysis not preferable for them, because there's that repression is perhaps necessary.
There's plenty of Irish people who
yeah, I mean, of course, but I'm talking about cultural. You can talk about cultural phenomena.
Well,
with some degree of accuracy.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know whether I would go along with that, but I do think that Catholicism can be difficult because at least as American culture, and probably Irish culture too. I don't know so much. I don't know anything about South American relationship to Catholicism or Spanish either. But because Catholicism here gives archetypal images at a very young age to children, the idea if you can teach a child, if you can teach a child to be a Catholic in the first early years of life, then you've got them for life. They'll always be, it's a kind of a fierce psychological system that gets imposed at an early age, and it makes it difficult. It just makes it harder sometimes for somebody who's had that kind of early education to gain access to the unconscious independent of what they were taught.
Yeah, because a lot of the modern generation, even in Ireland, which is staunch Irish Catholic, the grip of the church on them has loosened dramatically.
Yeah.
Yet they seem this same dynamic of unwillingness to psychologize seems to still be very prevalent.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of seemingly independent of the church influence.
I really don't know much about this, but my impression is that Catholicism in France and maybe in other parts of Europe too is not as is a gentler kind of relationship to religion, I think.
I was bringing up a question. I started laughing because of the. I started thinking of some of the deep Irish thinkers, James Joyce.
William James.
Deep thinkers. And then Alan's bringing up a question in mind. It even talks about there's the personal and conscious, and it's all unique to each of us. But then we all share in this collective unconscious, which is common to all of us. So it's a question about how it gets expressed in our different cultures,
yeah.
In the different cultures of humanity. Why it takes one form, or does it take one form as opposed to another form, or is it all sort of the same for all?
Yeah, like for Jewish, it's very different. It's actually, the whole discussion is a great discussion. You can't say, oh, you're being prejudiced or overgeneralizing, because I think the Jewish culture and the willingness to psychoanalyze compared to the Irish, it's more than anecdotal.
I'm asking a question as someone who's been living with this material a long time, who came at it as a scientist initially,
uh-huh.
And now who's living with this material a long time. Do you see there being a collective unconscious?
Well, that's part of the fascination that I have with fairy tales from different parts of the world. On my website, I'm analyzing tales from Melanesia, Polynesia, Eskimo, Africa, Siberian, Scottish, Scandinavian, I think, somewhere, English, German. And what's astonishing is to look at an Eskimo then and realize that the description of, Sidna, the description of this female heroine who goes to the bottom of the sea and controls the supply of seals and walruses for the hunters, that this description can be understood in terms of the same psychology that we talk about in Western psychology is remarkable. And Melanesian myth I'm working on, same. This African myth, that there are these universal. I mean, it's to me, I'm still completely blown away by the idea that in this African myth we find a story which resembles the mythology of Christ. I mean, it's a young girl, it's feminine, and it's a young girl, but there's a lot of similarities.
Mm-hmm.
There's surely evidence that there's something universal, a universal psychological process which is being manifest in different cultures, in different forms, but still the underlying structure is similar.
And what makes it, it's very interesting to me, what makes it sort of living is that you have to apply your own cultural knowledge, which we're limited by,
yes.
To what we know, and to understand that we can know something about history or race or culture. But what really matters is the interpretation now. I mean, that's how I see it.
Yes, thank you. I agree, absolutely. And that's what we do in this room. That's what I'm getting at about this process. That we are struggling together to do just what you said, and it takes everybody in the room to do it. We're struggling together to tease out and conjure up the meaning of this African story, which otherwise would be very difficult for us to gain access to because it comes from a foreign culture. But when we play with it together, and different people have different reactions, then we have that campfire experience, you know, which in it coming from our culture, we have the campfire experience.
Mm-hmm.
See, it's, those stories were meant to be told around the campfire.
I mean, it's almost as if we need stories to be the same, and we need to be told them over and over and over again. I mean, if it's teaching something about the consequences of action or a moral, even, you know, like, you know, we're human, so we might, not that I always think of mistakes, but we might constantly run into the same problems over and over again, and we sort of need to be, I mean, that's why there are Ten Commandments. I mean, that's why each religion has its barometer in there.
Well, and I would extend that even further to say that it is in stories that we become human, that the human psyche couldn't exist without stories, because our humanity, there's nothing in the DNA to account for our humanity. You know, the DNA of a human being is almost identical to the DNA of a chimpanzee. There's almost no difference. You know, and in terms of time, you know, it's only been 5 million years that we diverged from chimpanzees in evolutionary time. That's only time for a few minor mutations and a few chromosomes. You know, it's not time to create Shakespeare and Aristotle and Einstein. So, all the psychology that we live by and all the literature and all the emotional stuff that we go through in life, it has to be created. We have to create it in our mythology and then tell each other our myths. Which is why everybody goes to the movies, everybody, or they read books, or they read poetry, or they tell fairy stories. Everybody has to have stories.
It's interesting. I have a Labrador that we love, and he has bad dreams. You know, he's whimpering and running and stuff. So, you know, it's funny, this thing that we discuss, you know, the similarity of cultures, I'd say it's even wider than perhaps just humanity. And it also seems that there's two mistakes of presumption. One mistake of presumption is what they're talking about in other cultures or even other species is really different than what we are. But there's also a mistake of presumption that it's very similar to what we are.
Yeah.
Because, you know, part of when we discuss an African myth, you know, we strive and we have to be one point in striving to uncover the similarities. But in that process, we also, you know, eliminate some things, relevant things that are very far and different, will never be quite understandable to us either.
Yes.
And even with my dog, you know.
Yes.
My dog, I'm sure some of his dreams are the fear dreams I have, but it would be a mistake to try and project, you know, what my on him.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Go back to that very intriguing thing that you said, that for Catholics who, because the archetypes are pounded into the children so early, which is that can get in the way. You just develop more and you have to understand the concept, because
I'm just trying to think of examples so I can kind of be more grounded in saying this. I would say that if you're convinced that if you've been taught at a young age that you're sinful and that you're always going to be sinful, and the only way to get any relief is to through through confession, but you'll still be a sinner even after you've confessed. There's such a there's such an insistence on badness in that, that one is irredeemably bad. Maybe you can get a break from by going to confession, but you're irredeemably, you're still bad, still a sinner. That's an archetypal idea, which you can understand it the way Edinger is talking about it. You can understand it as we are all identified with unconscious archetypes, and we need to disidentify with them in order to become more conscious, so that disidentifying with the archetype is like being forgiven for your sin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can, if you can play with that psychologically, you know, you can work with that. But if you believe in your bones that you're a sinner and that's just the way it is, then it's not playful. it's the truth, and it wounds you. You know, it diminishes your confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to play with your psychology if you've learned it at too young an age in too literal a way, because you're kind of stuck with those literal. It's traumatic. You become traumatized by what you get taught. If you get taught it too young, you know, you're going to go to hell. If you don't go to church, you're going to go to hell. If you don't say confession, you're going to go to hell. You'll burn in hell. Those ideas traumatize young children. And once they've been traumatized, it's very difficult for them to approach Christian mythology or any other mythology in a playful way. Does that answer the question?
And there's predisposition for those people. I mean, you can take a really staunch Irish Catholic class, and certain people will probably take on that cross a lot more than others, right?
Well, I don't know about predisposition. I don't know about how would one ever know? I mean, we're learning stuff from birth, even before birth. So, you know, is it in the culture? I think it's in the culture.
Not the genes or DNA?
See, I don't think the genes have got room for that. Genes. The reason that we have a large cerebral cortex is not because of the genes to describe what the structure of the cerebral cortex should be, but because there's one or two mutations which determine that the cerebral cortex will continue growing for a longer period of time.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
And through use, right?
Yeah. If the cerebral cortex continues growing for a longer time, it's going to be bigger. And then the sensory input that comes in will have more room to roam around and be transformed by this bigger computer. But just because the computer is bigger, there's no DNA to say that the computer, to specify the programming. The programming is by sensory experience.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole field of astrology, which Jung and I study, not and by the Annie is, by the way, a very well-known astrologer in the area. She's pretty very knowledgeable. But you know, there's a lot of people that believe that there is a very strong predisposition towards that, called the stars, or there's a whole thing called epigenetics, or yeah, which talks about these predispositions from your parents. And yeah, I mean, this whole idea of Tobler and Blanca, or coming with a clean slate, is I think, you know, astrologers, for instance,
would very much argue
that there is these, like, you know, if you look at thoughts as a channel, that there's these very deep channels at age zero.
Well, people are definitely born with temperaments, that's for sure. People have different
cognitive abilities and all kinds of things.
But I don't think astrology says anything about the DNA. It doesn't specify DNA, genetic inheritance.
No, I mean, they don't claim to be a scientific, but they just argue that you know, in a class of 20 Irish Catholic kids, you can see trends before they enroll in the school.
Yeah. Sure. I guess I would just argue that what happens in the first year of life is enormously complex and much more subtle than we understand. There's an experiment that was done on ferrets, surgery on the ferret embryos before birth or at birth, such that the sensory input from the eyes, which normally would go to the visual region of the cortex of the ferret, was redirected. The sensory input was surgically redirected to go to the auditory area of the ferret. The area of the ferret brain, which would normally process sounds. And what they observed is that as these ferrets grew up, the auditory areas of the brain acquired the morphology, the fine structure of the visual region.
Right.
So that in other words, the organization of the visual region is determined by the sensory input. And if you send it to a different place, then that place will more or less become a visual region. So that's a very, very profound argument for learning. You know, even the basic anatomy of the brain is determined by sensory input.
The neuroplasticity level.
Yeah, it's the amount of structure that is acquired by learning that begins even before birth is vast.
Yeah, and they even talk about, like, I'm a terrible meditator, but I'm in a class of meditators. They even talk about, even at tender ages of 40, 50, that through neuroplasticity, it's very possible to change brain function structures. And, I'm not the poster child for that, but it's interesting.
This is the end of part two of the additional discussion of Derowick's Little Sister. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll listen to other recordings on this website.